Ashe. We'll pour to the creative spirit, the great Ashe out of which we all emerge. Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to that creative spirit by whatever name we know it, whatever name you hold in your heart, in your mind, whatever name your ancestors gave, whatever name you learned as a child, whatever name you believe it to be, whatever name you believe it to be in spirit or in science. Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to the first human beings who came into existence on this planet, the first human beings who raised the first structures, who cooked the first meals, who taught the first children, who had the first children, the first Africans, the first people who stood upright, who walked, who figured out how to stay on this planet, who figured out how to pass that knowledge on to their children and their children's children, the mothers and fathers of civilization. Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour the next libation to their grandchildren, their children's children, those who raised the great early civilizations of Kemet and Kush and Monomotapa, the great medieval civilizations of Ghana and Mali and Songhai and Kanem-Bornu. We pour to those who great the great civilizations of the Igbo people and the Hausa people and the Kikongo people and the Mbara people, the great Mande civilizations, the great Kikongo, the great civilizations of Southern Africa, the Bantu people, the great civilizations of Southeast Africa, the Dinka, the Shilluk, the Nuer. We pour to those millions who raised the foundations from which the world would learn what it meant to be human in the world. Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to their children who, upon the arrival on the shores of people they had never seen before, found themselves captured and marched overland, found themselves perishing by the millions before they were held on the holding cells and the open air pens on the coast of West, Central, Southern, and East Africa. We pour to the ancestors who did not know, as they were stripped of all clothing and sent denuded into boats, packed like animals and strewn their bones across the floor of the Atlantic and the Indian Ocean. We pour to them who in the last moment on Africa grabbed the sand and grabbed the dirt and put it in their mouths and understood that the only thing they might have to preserve their place in that continent was their memory of that place and their ability to pass it on to their children. We pour to them. Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to those Africans and their children who, finding themselves cast adrift in Santiago, Cuba, who found themselves cast adrift in Puerto Spain, Trinidad, and Port-au-Prince, Haiti, who found themselves cast adrift in New Orleans and Charleston and Mobile, who found themselves cast adrift in Salvador, Bahia, who found themselves cast adrift in Barbados and the archipelago that formed the Wayward and the Windward Coast. We found them in these places, learning Portuguese and Spanish and French, whose often first words was, "Oh my God," or "Madre de Dios," who found themselves praying to survive and pass on to their children the memories. We pour to those ancestors who are represented in the thousands buried in all the square miles of where we stand, and who sit here buried before us in 400 caskets forged of wood from West Africa with Adinkra symbols. Each one of them, each woman, man, and child, symbolic of millions. The children of those who could not be killed, we pour, Ashe.
Ashe.
We pointed their children who somehow survived the hells of enslavement and fought for emancipation in the Caribbean, the French, British, Dutch Caribbean, who fought for emancipation in South America, who fought for emancipation in Central America, who fought the struggles we refer to as the Civil War in the United States, who came out of that, marched out of enslavement through Reconstruction, and found themselves making great migrations, eventually ending up in places like New York. Their children's children, who making a way for themselves became our great-great-grandparents, our grandparents, our great-grandparents, our parents, those who, when the first bones were discovered in this space, held their hands and said, stop, no more. We are here to speak for those who can no longer speak with their mouths. We
History
pour for those ancestors.
Is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go and what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
You are listening to Melanin Live with host Chief Lance Jones. Melanin Live radio broadcast is an affiliate of Black Reality Think Tank, which operates on the timeforawakening.com video platform. Reach out to them at melaninlive@yahoo.com. All of our programs are archived. Just go to www.timeforawakening.com. Access the search portal. Type in the name of the program you desire to review.
I want to thank Dr. Rogers and my co-host. Are you on? Sister Bonishwa?
Can you hear me?
Oh, I can hear you now.
Okay.
I'm on. All right. If you would, I'd like you to introduce our guest.
Okay, Brother Lance, do you have a message to our people before we introduce our guest?
Well, I have decided to. We have a wonderful guest with us this evening, and we're going to go right into it for the sake of time. And people are very anxious. We have a good crowd on this evening. Let's go right into it this year. I'm excited. I'm ready to get going.
I can dig it. So am I. Okay, so our wonderful guest, our powerful guest this evening is Dr. Dennis Muhammad. He's the founder of the Peacekeepers Global Initiative. He's also the CEO of ENOTA, E-N-O-T-A Incorporated, educating neighborhoods to obey those in authority. Chief Officer of Business Development and Safety Affairs for NCUS, Dr. Muhammad has over 30 years as a consultant and law enforcement cultural diversity trainer. He also provided consultation and logistics for the Million Man March, Million Family March, Million More Movement, Hip Hop Summit, and Hip Hop Source Awards. He's a personal security consultant for rap mogul Russell Simmons, many national and international leaders. Our brother founded the Peacekeepers in 2009. An anti-gun violence meeting ended with boots on the ground after gathering at the TREME, Community Center. 75 men walked around the community meeting, greeting, and talking with neighbors. Before it was over, 100 citizens agreed to join forces to do something about the senseless killings and assaults that became the new normal in many of our neighborhoods. Join us as we welcome our brother Captain Muhammad on galvanizing black men to the role of protectors of their neighborhoods.
Thank you very much, Brother Captain Dennis Muhammad. Thank you for being with us this evening.
Brother, can you hear me?
I can. Very well. Thank
okay,
you.
Well, thank you so much for giving honor and praise to God for giving me another chance that I may be able to correct yesterday's mistakes. I am most certainly honored and privileged that you would give me such a great invite. I just want to check on something because I was able to reach out to the co-founder of the Peacekeepers. I just want to see if he's on. I called him, you know.
I'm here.
Oh, you're on. The
I'm
great
here.
Bob Law. Bob Law, ladies and gentlemen, if you want to talk about the father of Talk Black Radio, you can't talk about Talk Black Radio and not mention the great Bob Law. I was able to catch him. He's a very busy schedule. And I asked him if you didn't mind, Brother Lance, to join me because he not only he helped me in organizing the Peacekeepers around the New York area, but he's a man that is whose shoulders we stand on. So I just wanted to know, was he on? And if you don't mind, Brother Lance, he's not going to be able to be on it long with us, but I would love to be able to have him to also entertain a few things as it relates to our subject today, getting men particularly to take responsibility to patrol the community. Is that okay, dear brother?
Absolutely. By all means, I'm honored to have Brother Bob Law. Brother Bob Law, welcome.
Well, thank you so much. I'm pleased and honored to be here with you.
I must tell you, I was a young man growing up in the streets of Newark listening to you on the air. What was it, BLS back in those days?
I was on WWRL.
WWRL. And your brother's a dentist?
I don't have a brother.
Okay.
A lot of people consider Gary Bird and I like brothers, and Bird was on RL with me, and then he is
right.
Was with LIB doing talk during that period.
We're going back 20 years, 25 years, 30?
Yeah, too far back to try to identify.
Well, by all means, this is a people's station. This is our people's station, and we're glad to have you. I'm very honored to have both you men with us, and I want to jump right into it.
Brother Lance.
Yes, please.
Before you jump into it, my heart is bursting. I have to say something.
Please.
So I need a couple of seconds.
Yeah, and let me welcome, this is our co-host, Sister Bonisba Ayan, and she is a community organizer, so please, the floor is all yours.
Baba Bob Law, how are you?
I'm fine. I'm good.
I have to say this because my heart is bursting. When I was in Wingate Prep High School, you came to our school and heard a bunch of young revolutionaries talking that revolutionary talk, and you brought us to Jersey to WWRL Studios and gave us our own show called Black Relevance. And I was one of those students.
Is that right?
I was one of those students. Our show lasted about 3 weeks, maybe, because once we got into the studio, we got scared, and our revolutionary courage kind of left us. We were intimidated by that studio. But, brother, I will never forget that opportunity that you gave us, and I'm so thrilled to get the chance to talk to you.
Well, I'm delighted. I remember we did a lot of work with Wingate Prep. It was on Eastern Parkway in Brooklyn.
That's right. And then,
and then it was housed in the original Boys High.
Yes,
but I remember Wingate Prep, and And was that your name then when you were a teenager, when you were a student?
No, my name was Kathy Johnson at the time.
Okay, all right.
Yes, I had to get an original name, which is Boniswa Ayan now, but I was Kathy Johnson, and I remember you, and I'm just, like I said, my heart is full.
Well, I'm so pleased to hear from you again right now.
I say, thank you. That's what I wanted to say, Brother Lance. Y'all can move on now.
No, by all means, It's like a family reunion, isn't it?
Yeah.
Great.
Yes.
Brother Capital, thank
you. You just don't know what y'all just did. This man, let me share this with y'all. Y'all can appreciate. This is one of my mentors, and he's not only a mentor, but he's an elder. And I don't want to disrespect him because he always teaching me, you know, ancestral protocol. So I would like to ask his permission as our elder. Brother Bob, do I have the permission to speak today?
You know, Captain asks me that all the time. I always
say
no, and he keeps talking anyway.
You say always say no.
Hey, look, he does me the same way, so it's all love. It's all good.
All right, but yes, sir.
Thank you, Bob. You know, let me say this about my great friend. Everywhere we go in New York City, I would be somewhere, you know, I thought maybe Captain Dennis was a lightweight celebrity, you know, and I thought, you know, Bob was one of the old relics of yesterday. And so, you know, and everywhere I go, I see a crowd coming towards me, and I'm smiling because I know they're getting ready. Hey, Captain Dennis! And they go right past me. Bob! Bob Law! And he'll give me this look. Like, see, you just ain't going to learn yet, do you, son? So I enjoy my friend. And he's not going to be long, dear brother, on here. So I'm going to be with you. But let's get to the subject. And I'm going to let Bob, who started off, and have him to give his contribution, because I'm going to be with you, because he's going to have to jump off. If you don't mind, Lance.
Enough said, brother.
Ask him the question that you would ask me, and then let my brother, while he has the time.
Well, the initial question we were going to get into was the idea of the peacekeepers, you know, and where that vision came from. And I know that Brother Bob and that whole experience, the experience in the nation, really birthed the idea, the spirit for it. Can you, in a nutshell, go over that? And then, of course, Bob was there, and we were all there. I was there as a young lieutenant, and I mean, you know, I'm talking about the Million Man March, but this idea of the peacekeepers.
Well, go ahead, Bob, please.
Hey, that really is appropriate for Dennis. That's where the vision began. So he actually is the person who can best explain the vision, the idea, where it came from, what motivated him. So we might need to let him respond to that. I can talk about how the vision developed. And
that was the next question, dear brother, Bob. So okay. I think it's very apropos. Whichever way you guys want to handle it, let's.
Well, let me give the history of the peacekeepers, and then I toss it to my brother. What created the peacekeepers, dear brother? We were in New Orleans. I was in New Orleans, and of course, I have been doing sensitivity training with law enforcement for over 30-something years. And I had come to the conclusion, as I have been dealing with these police departments, that I was not going to change the culture of law enforcement. Mm-hmm. It was somewhat a downer to me, because there are great men and women in law enforcement who really love the training, but I knew that the culture of law enforcement was rooted in racism, and its history goes all the way back to slave catching. So I could not get no satisfaction in seeing any change of my commitment. So I thought, Brother Lance, that if I can't train the police officers to not to beat black people's heads, I said, well, let me teach my people how to keep the head out the way. Mm. I focused my attention to getting the community, particularly black men, ready to police and patrol their own community and accept responsibility. What really started the peacekeepers, I was in New Orleans, and I was invited by Minister Willie there at the Tremaine Center, which he read in New Orleans. And 3 to 4 days before I was to speak or come to the city, a black man, because he did not want to pay child support, he took a box cutter and slit the throat of his 3-year-old son. And I heard about that. It took place in New Orleans. And as I was going to New Orleans to speak at this gathering, that affected me. That affected me to the degree, what have we become that we were taking the life of our own children because we didn't want to pay child support? So I was invited to speak, and I changed my subject. It was over about 300 people at the place. I know about 150 people at the place. And I got to speaking, and you could tell I was moved by what had happened. So I asked the people, how serious were they in changing the reality of the community? And all of them were saying they were serious. I said, you're very serious. I said, then let's leave from here right now. Let's leave this recreation center and let's walk around the community and talk to these young brothers out here. And they were not expecting that. And of course, we did it. We walked around the neighborhood, and as we was walking, the people in the church on the porch was praising us. Oh my God, look at these men! Well, we left with about 70, because there were some sisters. We left with about 125 people, but we wind up with 150 people when we got back. We picked up 25 people, and from there, I started my first Peacekeeper chapter in New Orleans. Now, Bob and Bob, Russell Simmons, Erica Ford, and A.T. Mitchell, 10 years ago at Peace Week, invited me to New York to start the Peacekeeper chapter in New York. Mm-hmm. And my brother Bob has been at my side ever since. And if there's any success of why we're successful in New York is most certainly because of Bob. And I would like for Bob now to go ahead and explain the role that not only he played, but how important and significant the Peacekeepers have been, not only in New York, but around the country. If you don't mind, Bob.
All right. Good, good. Peacekeepers, There's a peacekeeper vision, and it is rooted in the central theme or vision of the Million Man March.
Yes.
When men gathered, because there was an appeal to their manhood.
Yes.
And the men said yes to that. That men were receptive to the idea. When we talked to them about taking the full responsibility for stabilizing the black community on our own terms.
Yes.
That appealed to men who were strong enough to respond to that kind of a challenge. Mm-hmm. Because there are a lot of men who are not strong enough to be what our people need at a time like this.
Yeah.
And so when the appeal goes out to men. It goes out to take full responsibility for your family, for your future, for your legacy. Take full responsibility for the quality of life in your community. You do it. We'll come together. We'll talk about it. We'll strategize. We'll train. But we are preparing us to take responsibility for us. Now, that is a strong and relevant appeal to a people, particularly Black men, who have been denigrated through media, ignored through history, trivialized, marginalized, to the point where many Black men really don't feel that they have any power or significance, or that they even deserve to be respected. You know, I've heard young who were in the street talk about how powerful they feel with a gun in their hand. And they point out that they don't feel power without that weapon. They feel valuable with all of the chains and the gold and all of the things that they do, from tattoos to jewelry, because they don't feel that who they naturally are, how they were naturally conceived and created, they don't feel that that natural person is of any real value. So the peacekeepers begin to talk to the hearts and minds of Black men first. The appeal is to the entire Black community, but it goes out first to Black men, as it seeks to renew their mind and help to establish a sense of manhood and a sense of dignity and a greater sense of self-value. Once you value yourself, then you don't have to tell people what not to do.
Right.
You don't have to tell them to put their pants. You don't have to tell them not to put drugs in their nose. You don't have to tell them not to drink, to become drunkards. You don't have to tell people who value themselves and respect them not to do things that is going to harm them, because they value and respect themselves so much, they would never do anything to harm them. And let me give you an example of how that philosophy works.
Please.
So that everybody can understand this. If you have There are people who have brand new, really clean, sportsy new cars, and they don't let anybody eat in their car. They don't let their young brother drive their car. They don't put the gas cap says unleaded gasoline only. They never try a more powerful leaded gasoline because they are afraid it might damage their car. However, many of those same people put cocaine in their nose. They put vodka and Johnny Walker and Jim Beam in their mouth. They respect their car more than they respect themselves. You know, they'll say, if you try to get them to stop eating things that are harmful and say you're going to die, they say, I got to die sometime. But if you say, put sugar in your gas tank, they don't try that. Say, well, your car's, they don't say then, well, my car's got to go bad, it's got to die sometime. They preserve it because they paid for it, they polish it, they clean it. It represents their status.
Yes.
What peacekeeper vision does is it teaches them, it renews their thinking, renews their mind, and it teaches them that they, as a human being, God created, as God created, they were already of great value. And they have to reclaim their and understand their value. And particularly if you are a man, it is your opportunity to take on the responsibility to control your own destiny.
So, and so I know people got to have a spark so we can spark in that area. Mitch McConnell, the give a damn.
We still here?
We are.
Okay. But anyway, let me just kind of sum it up. That is part of the vision is to renew the hearts and minds of our people and to have men take the lead responsibility in accomplishing that goal, because when men do it, it helps to establish a precedent that is carried on by the next and the following generations. Well, used to be a museum in Brooklyn called the Muse, and they had on display a diary, a slave captain's, the captain of a slave ship's diary. And it was open to a page in his diary that said, "'Tis from the black man that we fear revolt." Mm. And that is still the norm in this racist white supremacist society. It is from the black man. And so that they fear the resistance. And so it was the black man who was very much under attack, not simply arresting him, put him in prison, didn't say simply, but not only arresting, putting him in prison, denying jobs and a living wage, but the black man was under an attack that was designed to destroy his sense of self. It was designed to break his spirit. It was designed to make him feel worthless. And then white supremacy would be enshrined in his head. And there would be no need to even worry about any kind of revolt on any level coming from the black man. And so the peacekeepers targets rebuilding the spirit, rebuilding the sense of humanity, the sense of self with men. And then now that the men believe in themselves, they are eager as well as better equipped to go out into the community and talk to young people, and they talk different. They talk different to women. They talk different to children. There's a code of behavior that comes with it. There's a manhood training course that comes with it. But its real effectiveness is in its ability to rebuild a sense of humanness, a sense of self in the hearts and minds of black men. That is what is so unique and is the secret active ingredient in the peacekeeper philosophy.
Wow. You know, I've been blessed to sit and watch that process. In fact, I'm a student of a part of that process. Brother Captain, did you want to add something?
What's that? Say that again?
Were you going to say something? I did not want to cut you off.
Oh, no. I mean, my brother, he did such a great and articulating what we're doing. I wanted to add to what he's saying, because it was very clear that the word peacekeeper came from a concept. One day, as I was thinking about the name to call it, I was watching the United Nations. Yes. And one of the things about the United Nations, every member of the United Nations has what you call a peacekeeping force, the United Nations peacekeepers. And one of the things about the United Nations peacekeepers is that their only job is that if there's a nation that is having civil war within its own nation country, then another peacekeeper nation would send peacekeepers into that country to stabilize it, never to get involved with the war, never to get involved with the politics, but to be there, to be present for peace in order that innocent people do not get caught up in the war until that country solves its problem. And I said, wow, that's the black community. Civil war is when you're fighting against your own citizens, your own self. Well, we have civil war in the black community. We are the greatest killers and hurters and maimers of self. Mm. And so therefore, we're at civil war. So we need a peacekeeping force like what we established to be able to go into our community and stabilize it and create a atmosphere that innocent people do not get caught up. But the beautiful thing about the concept of the peacekeepers is that every member of the United Nations have Pakistani peacekeepers, the French peacekeepers. And I said, wow, wouldn't it be wonderful to have AME church peacekeepers, Nation of Islam peacekeepers, the Urban League peacekeepers, the Black Panther Band. Take all of these other organizations and institutions in our community and for one time, put aside our political differences, put aside our religious differences,
yes,
put aside our social differences, put aside, yay, yay, even our racial differences, put aside our gender differences. If we could just put that aside and come together for the common good of peace, then we have been very successful as peacekeepers because everything we just mentioned, we have as peacekeepers. We have white peacekeepers. We have gay peacekeepers. We have Christian peacekeepers. We have women peacekeepers. We have Black peacekeepers. We have Jewish peacekeepers. Why? You say, wait a minute, Captain. You got that kind of a coalition of people? Yes. Why? Because one thing I've learned that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad taught us, he said, everything in creation seeks peace. The lion, as bad as he is, with one swipe he could kill you. You run up on the lion, he would rather walk away than to attack. He would get up, walk away, listen, man, his attitude, hey, I don't want none but some peace. But if you come after him now, he would do what he has to do. Everything in God's creation runs away from confrontation. We the only people that you don't see some of us run away from confrontation because they want peace. So we take the same attitude. We have to be proactive, Brother Lance. And the beautiful thing about the Peacekeepers Global Initiative is that we have a very simple philosophy. We only ask the people, private citizens, to give us 1 hour of your time a week. We call it the hour of power. All we ask, give us 1 hour, brother, give us 1 hour, sister, and then put on what we call our signature color, which is orange. We have a mantra on our shirts that says, I am present for peace. And you put that on, and for 1 hour, you come together in your city. You may not even know one another before you became peacekeepers. Christian, Muslims, and y'all meet, and y'all say, well, listen, man, let's get on this corner, and let's just be present for peace. And do you know that has been the greatest contribution? Bob remembers one time we were in Queens. And, you know, in Queens, they have a lot of playgrounds. And this particular time, we were going to this playground, right? And, you know, the kids wasn't on the swings. The kids wasn't on the sliding boards. When you walked in the playground, there was dope dealers. You know, you walked in the playground for the kids. It looked like you walked on a daggone prison yard. They all up on the car bars, pulling up and down. They on the swing. They selling dope. They doing everything, you know, and the poor kids. They looking through the fence. They can't get on the swing because the dope dealers took over. So we went one time. We went into that area with the peacekeepers, and they seen us coming. And as soon as they seen us coming, they left. And of course, when they left, the little kids, we told the little, come on, y'all. And the kids ran. They got on the swing and they got the swinging. And as long as we was present, the children can enjoy. And so for 1 hour, after it was over with, we let the dope dealers, whoever, for them to come back to do what they got. The kids went back. But after a while, we said to the police department in Queens, if we can be there for 1 hour, and for 1 hour we got peace and the drug dealers leave, then when we leave, why don't you park that squad car?
So we leave. So now when they came back, they said, okay, well, we're going to come back. And then when they come back, they look across the street. They see that squad car, and it's, oh, snap. And they leave again. So now the kids got 2 hours. We realize, this is what we realize, very simple. It's not enough. It's not rocket science. When peace is present, violence is absent. When light is present, darkness is absent. We understand that principle. And the very presence of a peacekeeper in that bright color orange, and I'll tell you the history why we chose the color orange. It gives a look to the community, as Brother Bob was saying, it makes the man feel, wow. Instead of at him being at home, Brother Lance, looking at the 5 o'clock news with his remote control in his hand, and he's in on the 5 o'clock news, shooting on the east side, murder on the west side, triple homicide on the north side. And he's just feeling, damn. Instead of him sitting there not doing nothing, now when he becomes a peacekeeper, and for the 1 hour that he's been out there, there was not no shooting, looting, and tooting. So when he goes home and he sees a shooting the next day or out, he said, well, it didn't happen while we was out there. It didn't happen while we was out there. Now the person feels somewhat good. I did something. And then when they go out there and they talk to them youngins who they was afraid of, Bob will tell you, boy, they were afraid of them young people out there, boy. You couldn't get them older people. Man, them little young crazy niggas out there. And then when you get out there, you realize that that little dude that's got their head turned sideways with their hoodie on, once you take the hoodie off and pull his hat off, that's a 13-year-old kid.
Right.
That's a kid. And I'm sitting there scared of a kid. And then you realize they're not what you think they are. And then once you get out there and you build a rapport with them, now you feel good that to do nothing, Lance, is not an option. So I just wanted to say that and to add to the great work. You know, I get inspired when I hear Bob. Bob the only dude to get me inspired. I really wasn't in the mood talking to, but when I hear that dude, Bob, man, he makes me think, is that what we do, Bob? Did that.
Yeah, well, we all want to thank you, both you brothers, because, you know, as I was affected by it, and I've seen your great work firsthand. I was blessed to be with you, Brother Kaplan, when you came down to Greensboro. I spoke to the brothers in the Morningside, one of the communities, housing community. Yeah. It was all love. I saw the transformation happen right before my eyes as you spoke about the various initiatives, the various steps in the program, and the brothers came out. And how many branches do you have now? How many locations are you in?
We have 32 branches, 32 chapters. 32. We have a chapter in London. We have a chapter in London, England. I have just opened up 2 chapters in Tobago, 1 chapter in Tobago, and one of the brothers who was over the chapter in London, England, he moved to Trinidad. And when he went to Trinidad, he started a peacekeeper chapter in Trinidad. So we have London, England, Trinidad, and Tobago. And so I'm very excited about our international peacekeeper.
Yes, yes. Once again, folks, we're listening to Melanin Live with myself, Chief Lance Jones, and our special guest, both of them, Brother Captain Dennis Muhammad, the Peacekeepers, founder of the Peacekeepers, and his right-hand brother, who was very instrumental in assisting him in the early days in the formation of the Peacekeepers. The radio host, the great radio host that I remember as a young man, Mr. Bob Law, is with us. I want to thank both of you for being on. One last question about, and then we'll go to break. We'll open up and have some questions from the various audience members that are on live with us. Barbershop Talk. The origin of and effectiveness of Barbershop Talk. Can you share that with us?
Oh,
brother, let me say this.
And let me say, I was there. I was there with you in Chicago, and you and Russell Simmons, and we were doing that work together. Yeah, before I bring it up. Profound. Yeah. Very profound. Genius.
That's why, let me tell you, I was here in Columbus when I started the Barbershop Talk. The origin of the Barbershop Talk came out of 10-10-15, where the minister was calling for 10,000 fearless men.
Yes.
And the theme, if you remember, Brother Lance, it was titled Justice or Else, right?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Well, I knew prior to them going to Savior's Day to hear the minister, there was quite a controversy that white folks created, that Farrakhan is calling for 10,000 men to kill white folks. That was put out there. Farrakhan is calling for justice or else, or we're going to do this. And so I knew there was a great misunderstanding that our people had on that anniversary of the Million Man March. So I said, let me do a tour of barbershops in Columbus, Ohio. And I did 16. But when I started it, it was so great of an appeal that I wind up building a strong peacekeeper set in Columbus, because we was able to get at least 100 men out of the barbershops over the many barbershops that we went. I realized, dear brother, that the barbershop is where you can find the youth. The youth, Brother Lance, they're not in the mosque. They're not in the church.
Yes,
but for some reason, you can find them in the barbershop. I said, and Bob was on the line the other day when I talked to a friend in the past of his, I said that the last institution of black masculinity is the barbershop. And when you go into the barbershop, it's like, as you've seen, Brother Lance, it's like the United Nations. You go into the barbershop and it's neutral territory. You're able to discuss differences that you may have. You can discuss politics in the barbershop. You can discuss religion. Or the biggest discussion is always sports. And even some of those discussions in the barbershops create sometimes hostile conflict. But the barbershop, if you had something that you had on your mind and you thought you was a great speaker or you thought you had a great idea, then running in the barbershop, because there's no rules of people going to disagree with you. If you say something to the left, they're going to say something about it. But the beautiful thing that I realized about the barbershop, it is considered, Brother Lance, the second oldest institution in the black community. And you know as well as I know that the first oldest institution in the black community is the black church. Bar none, the first oldest institution in the black community is the church. The second oldest institution in the black community is the barbershop. And I said, wow, what great place for discussion. Now, when I went to New York, when I went to Chicago, Russell Simmons had got Rush Card to put up some money for the peacekeepers to go into Chicago and start a peacekeepers chapter, right?
Yes.
I had a problem with that because you know as well as I know that Chicago has probably the oldest gangs. When you talk about gangs, you've got dudes that's in Chicago called GD. It comes out of the, and many of us back in the day remember Jeff Fort. Most certainly Bob remember Jeff Fort. They was called the Black Recycle. I mean, it was called the Blackstone Rangers. No, the Blackstone Rangers. Wasn't it Blackstone Rangers? Yeah, the Blackstone Rangers. Am I right, Bob?
Blackstone Rangers.
Yeah, yeah. So they were back. And then Jeff Fort developed it to now he's in jail, but it's called now
the Gangster Disciples, the GDs.
Right.
So then they have the El Rukin, which is the Black Stone. Now, so when I said I was going to go to New York, and New York had some of the highest rate of homicide, I did not want to go with the tradition of going in and holding a mass meeting to talk to the brothers, because I realized, Lance, that there are men in Chicago who would never go on another side of town. So if
right.
I had a meeting on the west side, some of them on the south side are not coming, because that's how serious gang problem is. So I said to myself, what better way to get to the GDs, to get to the Four Corner Hustlers, to get to the Crips, to get to the Blood? What is the better way? Well, I know that every set has a barbershop that they go to. There's a barbershop the Crips go to. There's a barbershop the GDs go to.
Yeah.
So all I needed to know what barbershop they go to, and I don't have to say, is there any GDs in here? Well, if I'm in a GD neighborhood, then I can tell you 9 times out of 10, these brothers getting their hair cut, they GDs. So I had developed 3 questions, which is what has probably been the hallmark of the barbershop talk. I didn't want to get into the barbershop, and I didn't want to talk religion. And you know, Lance, the reason why I didn't want to talk religion, because religion is controversial.
Yeah.
I did not want to get into any language that not only was become controversial, but confrontational. So I stayed away from the very things that divide us. So, you know, religion divides us. It never unites us. So I didn't want to go and talk religion. And I know politics does the same thing. And guess what? Sports does the same thing. Man, I went into Chicago, and man, when I got to talking about the daggone Cavaliers, and I'm up in there, man, with the Bulls, you know, I had a problem. I had to keep my, I had to watch the hat. I couldn't even wear a Cavaliers hat or Cleveland Browns hat, you know, when you're dealing with the Chicago. So we stayed away from religion. So here's what we did, Brother Lance. We went in, we had a whole, we was able to take a video crew.
Yes.
And brother, and let me tell you who was the lead person who got me in the barbershop.
Who was
Minister
that?
Minister Farrakhan's personal barber.
Brother right, Arthur. Brother. Yes, right.
Brother Arthur knew all of the barbers.
Right.
So he set up in every side of town, the barbers, there was 13 of them. On different sides of town, but these were major barbers. We
right,
even
right.
went into Barack Obama's barbershop. Matter of fact, he got a chair there that's a shrine. Okay. Here was the really? Beautiful thing there, brother, why I thought the barbershop was so great. I went in and I asked 3 questions. There would be women in there sitting there to get their son's haircut. And there would be sometimes sisters who was doing nails. So we had women present too.
Yes.
And I said, and I would get with the brother who owns the barbershop. He already gave the agreement that we could come in. He would tell the people, you don't mind filming. You know, we would not release this. It's just for personal. If you got a problem with it, then we won't show your face, because, you know, our
right.
people always don't want to be seen. Anyway, so I would go in, Brother Lance, and it'd be on a Saturday. Place be packed. Mama's got the baby. The son's getting ready to get a haircut. Ain't nobody talking. Everybody's just waiting to get in the next chair. So I would walk in with the crew, and the barber would say, excuse me, ladies and gentlemen, this is Captain Dennis Muhammad. He's doing a tour around the country, and particularly in Chicago, on barbershop talk. And would you please, just give him your undivided attention,
yes.
Brother Dennis, you got the floor. And, you know, everybody's looking at me. And I said, listen, dear family, I want to ask you 3 questions. And the first question I want to ask you is, what do you think is the number one reason young Black people in particular are killing one another? The second question I want to ask is, what do you think is the number one reason there's an increase of police shooting down unarmed black men? And the third question I want to ask you is, do the black dollar matter? What can we do to keep the black dollar in the black community? These are the three questions, and I want to open up the floor to question number one. And let me tell you something, Brother Lance. When you give our people an opportunity to give their opinion, you'd be surprised the brilliance of their answers. And if they didn't want to talk, then it was my job to just put you on the spot. My brother right there sitting in the chair. What do you think? Well, me? Yeah, what do you think? Well, I think, you know. And so once we had that barbershop jumping, everybody, I mean, the place is on fire.
Yeah.
And once we leave there, Brother Lance, not only have we left there with a game plan and a solution, but the people enjoyed it and asked me, well, where are you going to do the next barbershop talk at? And I said, well, you know what Larry's beauty salon at?
Yeah.
What day is you going to be there? Well, we'll meet you there. And so the barbershop began to take a snowball effect.
Wow.
So I started there, and I've done, to this day, I had did 67 barbershops around the country, and I'm so excited. And let me tell you something, man. The barber, he's not only your preacher. He's not only your psychologist. He's not only your mentor.
Right.
I don't
right.
know what it is, Brother Lance, about the barber. When we get in his chair, we just feel like he's a priest. We start confessing stuff to the barber. Nobody else.
And
he's a man of trust, because mothers would drop their children at the barbershop and come back and pick them up. So we recognize the value of the barber. And guess what, Brother Lance? We have barbershops in the black community sitting. If we were to say, like the Native Americans, sitting on resourceful land, well, the black barbershop is sitting in the most key positions in the black community.
And I want to pursue that. I want to pursue that after this station break, Brother Captain, because when you blessed us when we asked you to come to Greensboro on High Point, you and I, you allowed me to attend the barbershop talk in High Point. Very successful.
Oh, yeah.
And for that, I thank you. The other piece is, and we'll talk after the break, we'll come back and we'll engage the audience. Those of you who have questions, please prepare your questions about the peacekeepers. Also, share the number, 215-490-9032. Share with all your friends, associates. Let's have this discussion as a black family. Brother Captain has been a servant, a good brother to many. Didn't get paid for this. They get donations. It's a 503C. We want to, and I'm asking all of you, to share if you can of what you can to the organization. Brother Bob Law, if you're able to stay on, I'm sure that there will be those who have questions for you. Like you to, just for a little while, if you can. And after the station break, we'll come right back, and we'll go right into the second part of this. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I've got to go. I'm walking out the door right now.
Okay, Brother Bob. Thank you for attending. I'd like to have you back again whenever your schedule will permit. Please.
No, you have to have him back to talk about not black only black radio, which is Bob pushing, but you need to hear what he has to say about rap music. So you got to get Bob Law back. He's on a mission, and he has things that he needs to say that I know y'all really would appreciate it. So if it's okay, we can work that out. All right, Bob, if it's okay with you?
All right, we'll make it happen.
Yeah, Bob is a historical figure in the radio industry.
And this is your co-host, Sister Bonice. So I got to jump in here, Brother Bob Law. I was going to ask the same thing. If we can get you back on to talk about the importance of black media, because so much of what I'm hearing, we all need to hear. So we yes, we need you to talk about that topic. And also to add to the number is 215-490-9832. That's the call-in number.
All right.
Thank you, Bob. I love you, Bob.
Okay, now.
We'll take this station break and come right back.
Here's your time for an awakening media lineup. Monday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., African Perspectives, with host Brother Oshi, Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Same time, same place. Continued Monday lineup, 6 p.m. to 8 p.m., Acres of Diamonds, with host Brother Jihad Ahmed, 8 p.m. to 9 p.m., Black Therapy Central, host Dr. Mawia Kambom and Sister Nataki Kambom, 9 p.m. till 10 p.m., Conversation Reparations, first and third Mondays. On Tuesday, 8 p.m. till 10 p.m., Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers. On Thursday, 7 p.m. till 9 p.m., Melanin Live with host Lance Jones, co-host Boniswa Ayan. Fridays, 8 p.m. till 10 p.m., Time for an Awakening, with creator of Time for an Awakening and host, Brother Elliot, co-hosted by Brother Richard. Saturday, 4 p.m. till 6 p.m., Black Sister Talk, with host Wanda Chambers. 7 p.m. till 9 p.m., The Elders of Sankofa. And Sunday, 7 p.m. till 9 p.m., Time for an Awakening, host Brother Elliot and co-host Brother Richard. Check us out, get informed, and get involved.
You are listening to Melanin Live with host Chief Lance Jones. Melanin Live radio broadcast is an affiliate of Black Reality Think Tank, which operates on the timeforawakening.com video platform. Reach out to them at melaninlive@yahoo.com. All of our programs are archived. Just go to www.timeforawakening.com. Access the search portal. Type in the name of the program you desire to review.
All right, let's get back to it. Brother Capmore, are you there?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
I want to thank you. Once again, we have Brother Captain Dennis Muhammad, founder of the Peacekeepers, with us. And, Captain, you want to share the number where they can contact you to find out more information about where they can give donations, where they can assist, wherever they can, whatever they can, and whatever they can lend toward that effort. Is there a number they can reach?
What they can do, go on our website.
Yes, sir.
It has everything they need, from the donation. If you want to make a donation, hit the donation button. We would love, we don't get no federal money. Not that we turn it down, but we believe that as long as the people support the work that we do, they keep us independent from having to change our language or capitulate to certain rules and regulations. I have a problem with that because I'm a member of the Nation of Islam. And sometimes they want us to be able to repudiate the minister, or they have a problem with Captain Dennis being a founder over the Peacekeepers, and he's Louis Farrakhan and all that BS. But anyway, you can go to The Peacekeepers, with an S, one word, thepeacekeepers.org, thepeacekeepers.org. Once you go there, you look at our website, take your time, go through it. We have so much on it. There's a donation button. There's a number that you can call. You'll see the cities that we have the chapters in. If you're interested in joining the Peacekeepers, you can do that right there on our website. And so it's thepeacekeepers.org.
appreciate it.
Indeed. The peacekeepers.org. Kevin, is there anything that you want to share before I go into the next session where we'll open up the calls? Anything that I have left out? I don't want to leave out a thing. I've traveled with you. You've been to my home. We've broken bread together. We've come down here at my request, at the request of others. Is anything that I should mention or you can mention that I have not covered? I'm sure the question will be many. And there's many more things I could talk about, for example,
brother,
going to Rockets Island, brother LL. Brother.
You listen, sister, if she so got anything memories. That you, if she got something she want to answer, you mentioned that's fine. You're doing a great job, brother. I mean, there's so much I've done in my life. You're doing a great job, brother. I'm just ready for any of the people want to ask any questions. It's the questions that stimulate talk that I can go into some of the things a little deeper.
And so often we don't give kudos, praise, or accolades to those who are close to us. But you're a man who served the minister for over 30 years. How long has it been?
43 years.
Serving our people, protecting this man who has put his life on the line to serve. And as a representative of the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad, really stood as best he could in those shoes and personified the spirit of love, protection, guidance for our people. And from being around that type of environment, it birthed you. You carry that same spirit, and we see it in the peacekeepers. We see it in the NOTA. We see it in all of your work, what you do with law enforcement, black law enforcement. So we can't thank you enough for putting your life on the line, putting your spirit out there, and not holding back what God has given you to give all. We got tonight on the call a dear friend of mine, a reverend out of Winston-Salem area, Reverend Lamont Williams. Are you there, Pastor? Are you there, Pastor Williams?
Yes, sir, I'm here.
Good. I just wanted to give you, I wanted to recognize you, give you a chance to say anything. I thank you for being with us.
Brother Lance?
Absolutely.
Brother Lance?
Yes. Yes.
You mentioned to
us Saturday morning, we would need it to be there.
Mute their mic. We're hearing external noises. Ask everyone to mute their mics.
Yes. If you would, please, if possible, to mute your mics. And, Pastor, is this a good time for you, Pastor?
Yes, this is a good time for me, Chief Jones.
All right. So I just wanted to acknowledge your presence in the building, in the virtual space tonight.
You're kind. Thank you for that acknowledgement. I've enjoyed the presentation thus far.
Now, you're having an event this coming Saturday, so I did want to mention that as well. This coming Saturday in Winston-Salem, is that correct?
This coming Saturday in Greensboro, actually, 408 Martin Luther King Jr. Drive. There's a host church, New Zion Missionary Baptist Church. And what we will be doing is giving away free. We've got about 1,000 meat combo boxes, and we want the community to come out and receive those. We'll be giving free flu shots. We'll also be promoting Alzheimer's memory loss prevention study from our Wake Forest Baptist School of Medicine. And so we're just excited that everyone will be moving and be able to come out and be a part of that. That's this Saturday at 1:30 to 4. And the address again is 408 Martin Luther King Jr. Drive.
I appreciate you. I appreciate
you. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Chief Jones.
Not a problem. Well, Captain, Barbershop Talk.
Yes, sir.
How can one get involved and maybe set up a contact to your organization to host bringing you in and gathering our brothers so we can have a day or afternoon or evening of Barbershop Talk?
Well, you know, Chief, thank you. Because of COVID-19, it really has changed the fate of organization, organizing, and meetings. I'm one who, when they talk about have insinuating circumstances, I'm 66 years old, and if I was to tell you all of my health challenges, COVID-19 would love a guy like me. He'd take me straight out the game. so I'm an avid man that I keep myself sheltered in. Yes, ain't nobody but me and my wife. I don't go nowhere, brother. If I do, it's when they say for necessity, that's for real. And even then, I send my wife out. I practice that now. You know, I love intimate crowds, but there's no way that we can do what we do. Now, you know, the barbershop has to practice social distancing too. There are some barbershops in certain cities, they just reopened. They had closed barbershops in a lot of cities. So we won't have the effect. That I love the intimacy, believe me. But for me to come into any city, I not only would jeopardize under these conditions the safety of those who would come and be happy to come in to hear Brother Dennis, but you could not put all those people in no barbershop. You still have to practice that. Now, what we are doing, dear brother, you know, Zoom is the baddest thing out there today, and it's safe. Zoom is safe. And I you still go get your hair cut. You still get your hair cut. There's no question about it. People still go to barbershop. But it will not have the kind of crowd. Now, what we're doing, Brother Lance, and this came up the other day because they wanted to bring me into New York. Matter of fact, Bob Law, pastor, wanted to bring me into New York. Mm-hmm. And he said to me, he says, he was excited. He said, well, are you recruiting, Captain Muhammad? I said, you know, Pastor, I'm always recruiting. I'm a captain. I've been a military man for over 43 years. I love men. That's what I do. Well, anyway, can we bring you to New York? I said, well, you know, Pastor, you know, New York is a different dynamic now. If you put a flyer and say Captain Dennis Muhammad, keynote speaker at an all men's only meeting, who's going to be talking about men taking responsibility, man, the place would be packed. And indeed, we can't do that now.
Mm-hmm.
So what we have to do is. He says, look what he said to me. I didn't know this now. He says, we're able to hold 20 people. That's the numbers now. You used to be 50. Now, New York broke it down. You can only hold gatherings of 20 people. I said, you know, well, I think it's smart. I like the intimacy of 20 people. And then Brother Bob Law comes on. He said, well, Captain, you know, we can have the fruit, you know, when they get to 20. You know, they the ones who are kind enough to tell the other ones the place for. I said, no, Bob, I would never put the FY in that kind of position that you got 200 people trying to get in. You only said, well, I'm sorry, only 20 people get in. I said, but here's what we can do. I said, if we can do 20, then we're going to build a website where you can see the time. And if I'm going to speak from 10 to 12, you go on the website, you put your name there, and if you're the first 20, we would let you know that show is sold out.
which is your name. So your name going on the list, and we got it at the door. So I said, oh, man, it'll be like I'm booking shows. So if you miss the dinner, 10 to 12 Captain Dennis, you can catch the 1 to 3. Hurry up, put your name on the list. That show sold out. I said, if I can do 20 times 5, that's 100 men I didn't talk to. So after that, talk to the first 20, you let them clean, you clean the area, stay alive, now the next 20. And you keep them distant inside. They still got the mask. I said, but I can't do 50, 100. Now, we could do the same thing in Greensboro. I don't know y'all numbers of occupation. I don't know what North Carolina, South Carolina's law is. I can only tell you what New York law is. You can only have 20 people assembled in a gathering. And then they're getting ready to stop that altogether. In Los Angeles, they're stopping it altogether. Ain't no assembly. So if it's still permissible, and if I was to come into Greensboro, I would do the same thing. I would say, okay, we could do 20, and the first 20 sign their name up, the name be on the list, the next 20 just the time, and y'all gonna work Captain Dennis like a Hebrew slave, but I love it. You know, I'm saying I love him. You know, I can do 5 shows. I'm sound like entertaining now. Off cam, you booked. I mean, I think you got 20. Okay, I booked. So what's about the next show? You still ride on the next show. How many of them? 20. So I love the intimacy, but I do want to practice safety. And I take that very serious. Now, that could be down the road, but I don't want it to be in a barbershop setting, because the barbershop setting, it should be a sterile setting.
Yes.
Barbershop should be sterile. This is where me and you go get shaved. This is where we get our hair cut. They have to have the clippers still. We do not want to do a barbershop setting when we got a virus out there like that. Man, we could do a community, and we could clean it, and we could stay within the law. That I'm willing, after New Year's, that if that's possible, that we could do that. I want to say to our pastor, who was just on, I love what he's doing. I want to say this, if there's some pastors that's on your show listening, I want to say this to the preachers, if I can say this.
Absolutely.
The church, it was the place, brother, if you remember, it was the place, Chief, for black folks in the 60s organized. The church is where we organized the civil rights movement. It was the church that took the lead into social change in the black community. When the church moved into what they call this progressive teaching, where they start teaching, generational wealth teaching, and it began to be mega, we lost the salary. We lost the salt. The scripture says, if the salt loses salary, then what good is it but to be trampled on the feet? If it loses its flavor, it has no value. So now the church is not the place it used to be. So the barbershop is replacing the church. Look at this. Let me say this, brother.
Yes,
if you were to count the number of black churches in your city alone, and in every major city, those numbers is unbelievable. We understand now, according to mathematics, that the Jewish community has more business per square synagogue, and we got more churches per more than businesses. Now look at this. Every church, I don't care if you Baptist, Methodist, AME, I don't care what it is.
Yeah.
Every preacher knows. Listen to me. Reverend, every one of your parishioners has to eat. Every one of your parishioners has to go to a supermarket. How come 15, 20, and 30 black churches can't come together and say, hey, Reverend, your folk got to eat like my folk got to eat?
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we put $20,000 together per church? You may have 300 churches. And let us build our own black Walmart.
Mm.
Why don't we build our own, not Costco, but Bosco? How come we can't build our own supermarket? And guess what? And we're going to put a kosher part in the place for the Muslims. How come we can't do that?
Yes. Yes.
We don't see enviness. And we'll go right to the white man's grocery market. We'll go to Costco's. We'll go to Sam's. And we ain't got nothing for ourselves, but there's a church on every corner, but the preachers can't even come together. So guess what now, Brother Chief? If the church can't do it, I went to barbershops to do it. Do you know how many black barbershops is in the city? They got the same disunity that the church got. They're competing now. But if we can unite the black barbers, if I could come and I could unite in New York over 2,000 black barbers in New York and put them into the Peace Barbers for Peace Coalition. Now look at the 2,000 barbers that's under one umbrella. Now you can go down to the daggone Asian place who's selling you them liners for $60 a liner and say, yo, listen, I represent 200 barbers. I'm not paying $60 for no liners. Now, if I want my people to come down here, we go straight to the manufacturer. Oh, no. You can get it for $20. See, we can go to Blue Cross Blue Shield or Blue Anthem and say to them, I represent 2,500 black barbers who need health care. Then do you want our business or do you not want our business? We'll be able to give them a $30 a month health care price. Those barbers don't have health care. Unity. Each of the barbers right there in North Carolina. You know my brother. The hair care brother manufacturer. You took me there, Brother Lance. What's his name?
Mr. Joe Dudley. Dudley Products.
Mr. Dudley Products. And you go to Mr. Dudley, you say, Mr. Dudley, can you produce a conditioner? Can you produce a shampoo? Can you produce a pomade that with these young men, instead of going to the dam and getting them dats and getting them arthritis, they can get a Barber for Peace pomade, Barber for Peace hair products, Barber for Peace shampoo and conditioner with their name on it, and they invest. And so every time they get ready to see some shit, brother, don't pay no money out there.
Yes, what I'm saying, this is what
unity would do. So I said to the barbers on this tour, if the church don't do it, then take the church as an example. Don't be like the church. They can't come together. All you barbers come together and y'all open up a black supermarket. Y'all can do it.
Must
don't that
do
make
it.
Sense, Brother Lance? Don't
it does make sense. We consider that our spending power is $1.4 trillion a year in foolishness. And if channeled, we would create more than 1 million millionaires in 1 year. We focus our dollars, spending black dollars with black businesses.
Man,
try to break that gravitational pull of what we've been taught and trained to do.
You got to redirect that energy. That's right.
It's a challenge for us, but it must be done if we're to survive.
It must be done, Chief.
And our children must create new habits to have enough love and respect for each other that they begin to spend with each other.
Debt? We can't pass on to them debt. Like our mamas and daddies passed on to us.
We got a serious problem, Captain. I will tell you this. While sitting with some gentlemen, I learned that we have, this is the first generation in the black community who will pass on debt to our children. That is what the report said, that for the first time.
We got this generational curse, man.
Yeah.
We got to do it. Listen, I, comments. I'm gonna, but I do want to hear more from your radio listener audience.
Yes, sir. We're gonna open up.
Share screen. Should I stop sharing?
Go ahead. I'm sorry, Brother Captain. Go ahead.
No, I'm just waiting for the next radio listener audience. And to the preachers, we love you, Reverend. We love you. God knows. And I love the Reverend who's doing great work in the church, who's out in the community. But we need unity. We need unity in the community.
We do. And I want to open up the lines now. If anyone has a question, go ahead. We'll take you one at a time. Who would like to chime in and share your spirit, a comment, question?
Go right ahead.
Am I on air? Yes.
Hotep, assalamu alaikum. I have a observation and maybe a comment.
What's your name, brother?
My name is Brother Fahim Knight.
Brother Fahim.
I'm from Durham, North Carolina.
All right. Thank you for being with us, Brother Fahim.
Yes. By way of Newark, New Jersey.
You and I both. Welcome.
Yes. Yes. Thank you. Brother Muhammad,
you see out and do the integral of us. He's giving us 20. Say 23 for 58.
Is that you, brother? Go ahead. 0158. Go ahead. Go ahead. 0158. Go ahead. We're listening.
There's two minors.
Did we lose, Brother Bain? Did we lose it?
They're still with us. 734. The last 40158. You there?
Wait, on the inside.
Brother was just speaking. If not, we're going to move on.
Somebody has subtracted.
Can't hear you, Brother. See, he's talking, but speak into the mic, please. All right. Anyone else? Let me open up the lines. Anyone else? Let's see, 5375. Last four.
5375. Can you hear me, brother?
I can hear you, beloved. Go ahead.
How you doing? This is Brother Ben. Greetings to you, Brother Lance, and everyone else who's there.
Yes.
Greetings, Brother Ben.
Greetings, Sister Babadiswa.
I love you.
I love you, too. I love you back. Okay, I was listening. I kind of caught the end, and you were talking about economic empowerment for our people. Mm-hmm. I think that is so important. But like the brother was saying, why we can't do it is because we have been taught and programmed from young, not to do for ourselves and for every man for himself. And that's something that we must get out of. I mean, we got to be, like you said, for our children. You just said we're going to leave debt to our children. That is so disturbing. And I think that it is incumbent on us that we must make a change. We got to make a change. We got to love each other, and we got to help each other. That's one of the problems we have, as we have a every man for himself mentality. And we must get out of that mentality.
Mm-hmm.
I say.
Great comment, brother. Sister Bonesa.
I want to share what brother said. There's a book, if you get it, it's called The Jewish Phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
The Jewish Phenomenon by Steven Spielberger. Now, the Jewish people were upset that this particular Jewish guy wrote this book. The Jewish Phenomenon. But he wrote the book bragging about the power of the Jewish people. And in the book, he talks about seven principles that makes the Jewish people control 90% of the wealth, even though they represent almost 10% of the population. And then he names the companies. And then he talks about. But one of the things that was very, very interesting in the book, the whole book is awesome. He said Jewish people practice, look at this now. He said Jewish people practice what they call delay gratification.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Delay gratification.
He said Jewish mothers and Jewish fathers were delayed enjoying the luxuries of life,
yes,
so that the children can have it. They were delayed in walking around in the brand. If you see them, they don't spend money or a whole lot of nothing for themselves, because they understand that they're preparing their children not to go into a lifestyle of debt, so the parent delays their gratification. Now, come on, man. All of us want to be gratified in our going to school and getting our degrees. We go to get our degrees so that we can be gratified in the kind of money we can make so we can enjoy a lifestyle. But we don't care. Think about our children. We be thinking about ourselves. We have the same attitude that our parents have. Shit, I got mine. You got to get yours.
We don't know
how to practice delayed gratification. We want it now. I want that car now. I want that house now. And because of that attitude, we sentence our own generation to death. And when I read that in that book, I said, my goodness. And I have practiced delayed gratification. I don't buy nothing no more. Well, I used to like the lizards in the gator shoe, and I ain't gonna lie to you. I used to like the Armani suits. I had a couple mink coats once upon a time. I had the Range Rover, the Mercedes-Benz. I had it all.
I remember rolling with
Minister Farrakhan. I had the flying home. But man, listen, man, I can't pass that down to my choice. I have to be able to deprive myself of the gratifications of life so I can give my children something. So I don't buy me a new pair of shoes no more. I wear the hell out. So you know how that old Jewish professor, he comes to college with that old raggedy sweater on, same old shoes, but he's wealthy. And you know why he's wealthy? Because he makes sure his children will never have to suffer like he suffered. When we can start practicing delayed gratification, then we won't pass on to our children death. We will stop trying to make ourselves something so that our children can be something.
That's the truth, brother. Listen, Sister Boniswa, I want to step in here because you brothers are so passionate. I got to kind of be a little persistent here. Y'all feeling me?
You feeling me? Go ahead.
Okay. I love my people, but I said that love you because that was my biological brother calling in. And
go ahead.
Yeah, so I gotta tell my baby brother I love him when I hear him, you know, giving his.
I know that's right.
Yes, because we have a very large family, and there's maybe 3-4 of us that are actually conscious, and so I appreciate those in my family that are conscious. But I want to make a point. With all due respect to what's been said, African people don't need to model anybody in terms of how to pass on wealth, values, all of that. We ran our cultures. We had a very humane and communal value system where taking care of each other was priority before the Europeans snatched us away from our motherland. So what we really have to do is go back to who we are. The Jews can't teach us nothing. The Chinese can't teach us nothing. We taught them, as a matter of fact.
That's right.
Everybody got their knowledge from the African. So if we start to love our African culture, learn it because we lost it, relearn our African culture, and learn that a major part of it is taking care of each other. If I'm not okay, you're not okay. There's a word called Ubuntu, which means I am because we are. I'm nothing without my brothers and sisters. So that's part of what my brother was talking about when he was talking about being programmed. We weren't like this before we got here. We were programmed into individualism, greed, materialism, and all this BS, and now we got to deprogram so that we can follow up with what we're talking about on this show, because I've been listening. It's powerful. But we got to deprogram our brothers, especially another piece from sports. We're sports addicts. Look at how much money is put into football and basketball and all of that. We could be pooling those resources and buying land. So there's work that needs to be done mentally, psychologically so that we can move forward. So I wanted to put that piece in.
Ms. Susan, let me share, and I love what you said. I've been to Africa 3 times. I've been around the world with the minister. And the Africa culture that you're talking about has been contaminated. The white man have affected us, even in the motherland. Even in the motherland. But we do know our history now. Don't get me wrong. But we didn't have to go to Africa to find values and norms. Hell, we had values and norms just 60 years ago. The norms and values we had in the black community that if you didn't disrespect your elderly, we didn't have to go to Africa to get that. We brought those norms, right? When you act with food and you disrespect, you got a whooping all the way from the neighbor all the way home. We understood the norms. The norms that we live by, look what the word norms mean. And I want to say this. I'm happy you said this. The Honorable Minister Farrakhan said, children will do what is natural until you teach them what is normal. Now, wait a minute. What does that mean? See, it's natural for a 3-year-old child to wet on itself. But it ain't normal for a 40-year-old man to wet on himself. So what we're saying, when you look at the word normal comes from the root word norms. Well, what is norms? The definition of norms is, look at this, established rules of conduct and behavior. We in the black community, and we had to go, we brought some of them over from Africa, but we had norms in our community. Let me tell you what the norms was. My daddy, he was the man who established the rules of conduct and behavior in my house, not my mama. Because in Africa, in the motherland, it was the chief who established the norms in the village. Look what my father would say. I would go in the refrigerator. You know what my pops would say? Hey, boy, if you didn't put nothing in it, don't take nothing out. That was my dad's norms. I would tell my mama, I'm not going to school today, Mom. Okay. I would go up there, and my dad would be standing in the doorway. So look here, boy. You either go to school or you go to work with me today. And he dug ditches. I would say, oh, damn, Dad, it's a miracle. I feel better already. I think if I leave now, I can catch second period. It wasn't my mother that said, be home before the dad gone street lights. That was my dad. It was my dad, man, that when he came in the house, my mama did this. I got 13 brothers and sisters. It was 8 of us at the table. And my mama would not see us until my daddy got home. We'd be hungry, it's all outdoors. And we couldn't wait to hear his truck pull up. And then when dad get home, he kick off those boots, wash his hands, get the noodles, and she shoot him at the head of the table. And guess what? She didn't set a plate in front of my father. She set a pot in front of him. And I seen steam come off my father's plate. He had the best pieces of chicken. He had butter on his biscuit. He didn't have the daggone ice cube. He had the whole damn ice tray in his Kool-Aid. I used to sit there and look at my dad. And I used to say this, Lord, I can't wait till I be the man of my house. My mama would put our little food in front of him. There wasn't no butter on our biscuit. We had one ice cube. See, he was the man to establish. We had all of that. The black family has been broken up.
Right.
We don't have to go to Africa to pick up norms. All we have to get back into norms we was practicing 60 years ago.
So,
if
brother,
let me
clarify something. When I say go back to Africa, I mean African values.
Oh, yes, of course.
Tradition.
That's where we brought them from. I agree with you.
Because
I'm not in disagreement with that.
Yeah.
I'm in agreement with that.
We're on the same page. I just want to clarify what I'm saying.
And the only reason why I'm saying that, sister.
No, brother, I hear you.
We spend too much time looking back.
So, brother,
a whole lot of time looking back.
I'm not saying to go back anyway. I'm saying to reclaim our African values, because the majority of us were taken from the motherland, primarily West Africa, and I'm talking about the past 400 years. I'm not talking about, before that when we did excellent things. I'm talking about the majority of us that were taken from West Africa. We brought with us from West Africa those values of communal activity. As I said, Ubuntu, I am because you are. We brought that here with us, and it remained with us. Just the longer our minds become Europeanized, the more we lose those values. My father was one man out of a large family, and I had four aunts who had no husbands, or they kind of, you know, men came and went. But you know who kept our family together? That one black father who was mine. All my cousins, none of them had fathers that were present. My father was their father. See, that's those African traditions and values that I'm talking about and that you're talking about.
Yeah.
That we had, that we have to reclaim. That is the word I would rather use.
Yes, ma'am. Now, like, listen, let me say this. See, one thing I learned about the black people's mathematics, black people's mathematics is addition and multiplication. White folks is division and subtraction. All I'm going to do with you is add to what you're saying and multiply. I ain't taking nothing away from what you're saying, and sister, and I ain't going to try to divide. That's our mathematics. We in agreement. I was only saying, if you take a look at the majority of our people, not only have they never went back to the motherland, they don't talk about it. Because they have bought into the image that has been portrayed of the motherland. And let me tell you something. And Hollywood has been guilty of portraying. I used to root for Tarzan. You think that's crazy?
I
used to root for a white man and a boy and a monkey.
Yeah.
And a white woman to beat up 100 black men, and I'm rooting for Tarzan. That's called self-hatred. I used to root for John Wayne to beat up the Native Americans.
We all did.
All of us was like that. So when you're talking about taking black people, and we have to not only do we have to be reformed, we got to be transformed back from a savage to a human being. The things we doing to one another, sister, is so horrible. That you know, man, this ain't never. Do you remember the time everyone on here, you OGs, that if there was a plane crash, we were praying no black people was on it? Do you remember the time if I stumbled my toe in Mississippi, you fell it in Alabama? Do you remember when it wasn't called Tony Brown Journal, it was called Black Journal? Do you remember when James Brown just said, "Say it loud, I'm black and I'm proud"? Do you remember that when we was coming up in the 60s, as we was organizing and rising up, the enemy had a determination. His determination to keep us down was not as great as our determination to rise up. And if it wasn't, then we wouldn't be talking about it right now. You feel me? So we're in a condition right now that if you open up this line, everybody on this line can tell you what they think the problem is. And you know what? And when nobody disagrees. If you was an educator, and I said, what you think black people about? And you know what you say as an educator? But I think, number one, they need education. They need proper education. If you're a businessman, well, what you think? I think they need jobs. They need jobs, brother. That's a problem.
And everyone would be right.
If you was a preacher, man, they need God in their life, man. They need God in their life. If you were seen, ain't nobody would be one. If you was a single mother, they need men. They need fathers. If you was homeless, they need a house. And nobody would be wrong. And if we had to ask, if we had to pick out of all of the many problems we had, which one takes priority? Even in the doctor's field, when there's triage, it's called triage. If you had been in the medical field, triage is if there's multiple killings, then the doctor has to make the decision which one of these patients require the attention first. And if there's one who looked like he's not going to make it, they would dismiss him. We have to ask the question, out of the pain, out of the suffering, out of what we came through, if we had to pick one that I mentioned, which one would be the party? And let me tell you something. It ain't a hard answer. You know what the answer would be? You have to stop the bleeding. Out of all that we're going through, if we don't stop this bleeding, this killing, then there ain't going to be no damn doctor, no patient to send to the teacher. There ain't going to be no businessman to give no job. If we don't stop the bleeding, the killing, we must stop that first, the hemorrhaging. They create an environment so that the social doctors, the business people, the educators, the scientists, now they can go to work to solve the problem.
So you're saying that, and Brother Kaplan, if I may, so what I think I'm hearing is, and others can chime in, is that once we stop the bleeding, that comes out of a recognition that we are one, that there is a greater appreciation for each other. There is admiration and love and recognition that, as the sister mentioned earlier, that I am because you are. Because stop the killing means that a consciousness has arisen.
Yeah. Imagine we have my sister on the line right now, and I put before her these young sisters and these young brothers who don't know jack about the whiskey. And I put my sister right now in front of them. That's your value. Teach them what they don't know. You do. Create the opportunity for the doctors, the lawyers, the educators, the preacher, every brilliant professional we have in our community. We got to put them in a position to do that craft. But we can't do it if self-hatred is keeping us divided. And all we want to do is call ourselves doctor. I hate the term doctor. You called me that. I don't use that. Even though I was given this as an honorary doctor degree 6 years ago. I said, that title don't mean nothing to me. But when you got people that pay big money to become a doctor, a PhD, see, when you bring these Negroes together, they ain't coming together to listen to nobody else. They come together to give you their philosophy. And most of the time, these summits, these conferences, they come in as a panel. They say what they got to say, and they leave. There's not nothing but, we call it, nothing but intellectual masturbation. And with all the brilliant minds that we got, they got it. We can't come the hell out of this tradition. I mean, so there's a problem. And the problem we have to address. The Million Man March did something that never took place and has never been nothing as great. The 25th anniversary and 25 for Muslims, the 25th surah of the Holy Quran is titled El Quran, and it's called the Criterion. One thing about the 25th anniversary we just had the other day in October, the 16th or the 25th, it is the standard. The Million Man March become the criterion now. This is your standard by which we measure organizing black people. You need a blueprint? Look at the Million Man March. Look how the minister had 98% of the people on that daggone law was Christian, even though a Muslim called it. Look how we sit down with every organization, ODG, and we came together. How did we do that? See, because we had a standard. And if we don't take the standard, then we keep throwing away the blueprint because we think we know better. Well, and that's why we will never accomplish nothing. I had used the peacekeeper standard. I mean, the standard of the Million Man March to create the peacekeeper. I knew the minister had to sit down with people that we had differences with, but he had to sit down and settle those differences because the unity is greater than the differences. And he did that. And I said, damn, if the minister can do it, if the minister can sit down with the Christian, if the minister can sit down with some Jews, if the minister can sit down with some white, if the minister, so I can do it. And then when I did it, I created the peacekeepers. But you have to support your own ego to make it look like you the only one knows something. So when I go into these barbershops, I'm a member of the Nation of Islam. I can open up my mouth and take a conversation and have people like, teach, brother. But I keep my mouth shut because I allow the people to talk. And that's something that these big time Negroes don't do. Sister, we don't have black leaders. We have crisis managers. There's no black leaders in the black community no more. They are crisis managers. And all the time they come know, is when there's a crisis. They're not making the necessary proactive approach to take us to the next level.
Hey, brother, how you doing? Brother, I hear you are so passionate, but I'd like to chime in before because I got to take off for a minute.
Trust me, you got to catch me, brother.
I enjoy your passion, though, Brother Captain. I feel you. Go ahead, beloved brother.
Yeah, brother, I'd just like to say something. My brother mentioned Christianity. I think that is one of the things that was so detrimental when we accepted it. I know we accepted Christianity at the, you know, the thought of death, at the threat of death and hanging and all this other stuff. But once we really accepted it and we took their religious belief, the religion, it's one of the things that messed us up because we are a spiritual people.
Yes, we are spiritual.
And they use our spirituality against us. And then we accepted this Christianity, and those two just do not mix. Religion is one of the worst things for our people. We are spiritual, and we have to get into our spirituality. That religious stuff, religion is like, what word am I looking for?
Pacifier.
It's a pacifier.
Really, it's man-made. Religion is man-made.
Religion is man-made, and it was made by someone who had our worst interests at heart. They gave us religion so that they could sleep. They gave us religion because religion turns men to mice. When I was a young kid and I went to church, I knew something was not right, that something was missing ever since I was a young kid. But I couldn't express it because you get slapped in the mouth. But as I got older, and I just said, something just is not right here. We're worshiping a white God. Where is our God? And that is put into all of our children, and that's one of the things we got to stop. We got to show them black people of substance,
come on, man.
Black people in power, black deities. If you start a young kid off with a white deity, his entire life he's going to feel like something is missing. I know because I did. So I'm just saying,
if I was in the church, I would have to say to you, amen, brother.
Amen.
Perfectly said.
If I had said that as a Muslim,
I may would have offended Christians. So I'm very conscious of that. I don't want to offend nobody, but that's what I would say if I felt someone was mature enough to really hear that and not take it as a personal attack to what they believe in.
Let me add this, Brother Captain, if I may, and dear brother, 5375. We are where we are. Our people are scattered, and we're a little bit everything. Atheists, Jain faith, Christians, we're all over the place. But in order to find common ground and the unity, can we be skillful enough, patient enough? As I see many others do, we have Reverend Pam on the line, a dear friend of mine and business partner and colleague. As the minister does, he sits down, as Brother Captain mentioned, he sits down with the Jews and whites and all over the spectrum. Can we be skillful enough for the sake of our children, for the sake of our future?
Come on.
Can we be skillful enough?
Come on.
To synthesize the message, even with someone who's not a co-religionist, or who's not in the conscious community? Can we be skillful enough to win them? At least to get some level of commonality that we as a black people can move forward despite the differences. That's where we need to go. That's the skill. That's the art, in my opinion, because I've seen it done. And it must be done in that way. If we're to find synergy and unity, that's what happened. That's what needs to happen, in my opinion. But I didn't mean to cut you off. Go ahead.
But let me say this, dear brother. You said something I have to speak on, which is absolutely correct.
I found out that religion is not the conversation that you could put us in the room and we're going to agree on. I found out politics is not the conversation you're going to put us in the room and we're going to agree on. I found out sports, and I found out even social status and differences. But I did find out that there was one thing, and of course, because it was about black men, there was one thing that was not controversial, and that is being a man.
Yeah.
No debate. It's not debatable about that. It's the only thing that we could talk about. Either you are or you not. Ain't no, well, you know, I think. See, so I stayed in an area that did not produce controversy. And being a man did not produce, so you're a Christian man, a Muslim man, a black man, or what? See, being a man. Because, listen now, because the role of the man is the same in every race. So if we get away from what a man is, and there's no better definition, my God. Ooh, the definition. And when I was in the barbershops, brother, I would always ask the question, every brother in here, could you give me a definition of what you think a man is?
Brother, one minute,
I got a videotape. I'm not going to tell it. But I would love to come back at another time.
Yes, sir.
And I want to finish what we really were supposed to talk about, the men patrolling the community, but this was a nice filler out. It was a nice filler out. And I promise you, if you would have me, I promise I would come back and we would go into some things further. And this is no diss to our women. I think that this is the year of the woman. And I'm so proud to see the women today and the roles that God is putting them in. And we'll talk about it another time.
Yes, Sister Bonispa, any closing comments, thoughts?
This was a great show. I'm glad, a great dialogue. And I'm very glad to hear black power from black males. And just that we keep on doing what we're doing.
Thank you. I thank you all for being with us tonight. Once again, we had with us Captain Dennis Muhammad, the founder of the Peacekeepers, who's doing a great job in the black community with building bridges where there's division among our people, our brothers in the streets. And we want to help him. And please remember to reach him at thepeacekeepers.org. Thepeacekeepers.org. And I want to give a shout out also to Reverend Pam, the president of the
Africa's Brain Bank.
Africa's Brain Bank, I'm sorry.
Tell me about it.
And our CEO, Mr. Kumba. And I thank you all for being with us. Thank you for accepting. Be blessed.
I was just listening.
Wake up, everybody. No more sleeping in bed. No more back thinking. Time for thinking ahead. The world has changed so very much from what it used to be. There's so much hatred, war, and poverty.